Hello, it's Tom Slater here, Deputy Editor of Spiked. I'm hijacking Andrew's podcast for just a minute to let you know about something really special. Spiked has a new book out just in time for Christmas. It's called The Year the World Went Mad. It is a collection of our best articles from 2020, and it is utterly brilliant. It has contributions from Andrew Doyle, of course, from Brendan O'Neill, Joanna Williams, Ella Whelan, Julie Birchall, Fraser Myers, and more. It is your essential guide to the year of COVID, lockdown, and identitarian craziness, and it is a mere £14.99. It's the perfect Christmas gift, and all proceeds go to Spiked, so we can keep up the fight for freedom into the new year. So, if you want to secure your copy, just go to spiked-online.com/book. Or, if you want to get one of a limited number of copies that we have, signed by Brendan O'Neill, we're giving those away to anyone who gives £50 or more to our Christmas fund drive while stocks last. To get your hands on one of those, go to spiked-online.com/book and just choose the donate option. Thank you all for your support. And now over to Andrew.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle. Today's guest is Julie Bindle, who is a writer, journalist and broadcaster. She's been a lifelong campaigner against violence towards women and children. As a feminist, she's been subjected to numerous instances of no platforming and intimidation by activists, particularly on university campuses. And we explored some of that during the course of our conversation. But we also chatted about her most recent book, The Pimping of Prostitution, Abolishing the Sex Work Myth. I find Julie fascinating and articulate. She's always a pleasure to talk to. And I think irrespective of whether or not you agree with all of her views, you will find her arguments compelling. So let's crack on. This is Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle, and Julie Bindle. So I wanted to start with a question about language, because I've noticed a kind of shift and a kind of mealy-mouthed quality when certain companies and things are talking about women. So, for instance, we've had Femcare, Community Health Initiative, talking about menstruators. Kotex, which is this brand of sanitary products in the US, talking about menstruators. Tampax, talking about people who bleed. We've had Sands UK talking about birthing partners rather than mothers. CNN going on about individuals with a cervix. What the hell is going on?
Well, it's pure misogyny, and it's a capitulation to the bullies. So, for example, you know, you mentioned SANS, the stillbirth and baby loss charity, that has actually been compelled to apologise to women that took offence at this birthing parent twist of language. It makes a nice change because normally, of course, they capitulate. I mean, pretty much everybody and every organisation on the planet at the moment is capitulating to the extreme, you know, trans bullies. But the issue about it for women isn't that we think that biology is destiny. In fact, feminists have always argued against that. We've always said, look, we'd like to see an end to gender. We'd like to see an end to prefixes such as Mrs. and Mr. and the like. But what we do understand as feminists is that our biology is used against us. And it's also something that, you know, is specific to us. So not all women can have babies, but only women can have babies. So the idea that you can suddenly create a new reality by suggesting that men can give birth is completely bonkers. But it's also eliminating the experience and therefore the oppressive circumstances under which women seek maternity leave, suffer miscarriage and stillbirth, end up being primary carers for children and responsible almost solely for raising them, and of course for not being employed or for losing their jobs because they have had children. So it's rewriting the entire experience of the vast majority of women. And you know, you mentioned menstruation. Well, this idea that not all women menstruate, well, come on, I mean, let's be honest. Yes, women stop menstruating at some time in our lives. Yes, there might be the odd rare occasion when somebody has, a female has a condition which means that she doesn't ever start her menstrual cycle, but that's so rare. And men do not menstruate. So we all know it's nonsense.
Well, see, because I understand why people might apply pressure to change certain language. You mentioned the use of the word MS rather than Mrs. or Miss. That makes sense because, of course, otherwise women are just trapped in these categories of married and unmarried according to their title. That makes sense to me. But the idea of changing or erasing the word women, I mean, we've even had WOMXN, mm-hmm. which is catching on absolutely everywhere. God knows how the hell you pronounce that. Wimixin or something, I don't know. But why do we never see this with men? We don't ever see MXN. We don't ever see men described as inseminators or people with testicles or, you know, that. Why doesn't that happen? What, I mean, maybe it's misogyny, like
it
you
is.
Say.
I mean, it's sexism at best and misogyny at worst. And what it is that the identity of women is up for grabs. So we've always been, as women, defined by sexist men. Not all men, of course. I have to get that one in quickly. But sexist men who decide whether we're sluts, whether we're prudes, whether we're ugly, whether we're fuckable, or whether we're attractive. I mean, really, we have been defined by men. And feminism is about breaking out of that, stopping relying on male approval, not caring if men like us or not, not caring if we fit to that particular stereotypical model of femaleness that is often demanded of us. And so we resist being defined by men. And now look what's happened. All the leftists, the Owen Joneses and the like, who seem to, you know, argue that they like women, but I think only women with penises, then tell us what we have to put up with in terms of the descriptors that we use, the way that we demand our sex-based rights that we fought for decades, and all of a sudden men know better than we do. Well, we're just not having it.
I think that's fair enough. I've always been really wary of terms like misogynist, racist, when they're thrown about, you know, without cause or without solid evidence. But I can't get around this. I can't see as anything other than misogyny. And also with a lot of this discourse, I've seen a lot of quite explicit misogyny of a kind I haven't seen for many, many years. I mean, particularly with the J.K. Rowling issue, some of the trolling she had was explicitly rape threats, sexually aggressive in nature, a lot of the language. I don't think you can describe this as anything other than misogyny. And it's weird to see people on the left going along with that, or at least tacitly endorsing it. That's strange to me.
I mean, look, women have a problem with some men on the left and some men on the right. Neither are particularly enamoured with feminism, because what feminism's about is suggesting that men have too much power relative to women and that they are going to have to relinquish that power. Now, that's unlikely to happen, so therefore we make certain demands, such as that men are, for example, if they rape, are convicted of rape, and that men are told that domestic violence is unacceptable, and that men are also reminded again and again that they shouldn't have special privilege because they've been born with a penis. And, you know, that can be irritating for men that are used to having all of this, in the same way as I have certain privileges that I would be reluctant to give up. But I agree with you. I think that there is a particular problem with men on the left. And it's that they don't ever extend their class analysis of the workers, of the proletariat, of those that have been born into disadvantage. They don't extend that understanding to women as a class. And of course, we know that women are a class. We know that we have some things in common. And I would say that probably the only thing that we have in common globally is the fear and reality of male violence, because nothing else really divides us. We don't actually go around wanting to look at each other's cervixes or talk about childbirth or even have babies. Some of us are rich, some of us are not. You know, we populate the planet. But we do understand that for now, under patriarchy, and none of this is natural, none of this is meant to be, but we do understand that we are very vulnerable to male violence and abuse, and that we have to resist that, and we have to somehow end that tyranny. Now, what the trans activists and what the men on the left, such as Owen Jones and his cohorts, are saying is that, yes, okay, we understand that sometimes women suffer rape and murder at the hands of men, but trans women have it much worse. And trans women are asking you not to use terms such as female genital mutilation, because not all vulvas are female. I mean, that is actually said. The term female genital mutilation is a transphobic term.
I mean, if that's what you're getting offended about, with that concept. I think your priorities are slightly off.
Unbelievable. You know, but also the fact that one trans person said to me, a trans woman once said when I was highlighting the numbers of women who died at the hands of men that one year, it was well over 100, unfortunately. This trans person said to me, how dare you exclude trans women from this? And I said, well, I wouldn't. Why don't you actually do the list yourself? As black people have constantly named and counted the deaths of black people by police officers, women for a long time have documented the pattern of male violence, of fatal male violence. Why don't trans people do this in the same way that actually gay men, when there've been homophobic murders? And this person said to me that what I didn't understand was that at least when women, cis women, are murdered, we have the dignity of not being misgendered. Can you believe this?
I don't understand where this is coming from. This is, like I say, priorities all out of sync here. Unbelievable. Because it sounds like what's happening here is feminists are being, and particularly gender critical feminists, are continually being smeared as transphobic. When actually, of course, you would be for rights for everyone.
Of course.
Presumably. Yeah, so it's not that at all. It's about a kind of projected sense of something that isn't actually being said.
Absolutely what it is that they want the bitch to shut up. They are sick of the bitch.
But then what do you make, though, of, I mean, like you say, the uniting principle of feminism is the fear of male violence and the potential for male violence. But do you not see that there's a kind of rift now that is being driven within feminism because of these debates? You know, we had Judith Butler in The New Statesman claiming that your position is actually a fringe mm-hmm. position within feminism, a marginal version mm-hmm. of feminism. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, that's probably one of the most comprehensible things that Judith Butler's ever said, if they were the words that she used.
Yeah, she's not the best writer.
She really isn't. And I'm sure she's actually much more interesting in person than she is in her writing.
Oh, she is. I've seen her talk and she was lucid and
quite
funny.
A lash.
But then you read her book and you think, well, this is utter, it's like a robot wrote
it. Totally. Well, it possibly did. But the problem with her assertion about this being a fringe position is she's completely wrong. This is about young feminists in particular being bullied into silence or bullied into capitulation with the ideology. I get emails, I'm contacted every single week by young feminists, either in universities or elsewhere, who tell me that they are in feminist societies or feminist groups or just women's groups or even book clubs where they read, you know, books and have a chat about it and drink a bottle of Prosecco. I mean, not even particularly conscious feminists who are told by men, because you're not allowed to have women-only gatherings anymore, who are told by men that sex work is work and you're not allowed to have a position that says it's actually demeaning, it's abusive, it's harmful, and men shouldn't have the right. They're also told trans women are women, because of course it's no skin off their nose. It's a good ploy to silence women. And it's a good ploy to show that you're progressive while still kicking women and calling them witches. So it's perfect for them. So these young women know fine well that this trans women are women stuff is bullshit. At the same time, they agree with my position and the position of all of the feminist friends and colleagues I've got worldwide, which is that, of course, trans people deserve human rights, dignity, and protection from abuse. Of course they do, in the same way as gay men do, lesbians do. Mm-hmm. Women do. But this is not about that. It's about colonizing the experience of women, telling women what womanhood really is, and then telling us that we are the oppressors. It's quite handy. Women that speak out against this ideology have now become the oppressors of men who claim to be women. So she's wrong. It's not a fringe position. It's a majority position. But the bullying and the silencing is almost McCarthyite.
Like you say, it's not that it's fringe. It's more that most people feel under pressure to say the right slogans, to say the right things and to mischaracterize them.
Completely. I mean, I've been in this game, you know, being bullied by these people. And it's a fringe group, actually, of trans activists.
That's what I was going to say.
These are the extremes. I mean, I have more trans friends than exist on the internet, the really hardcore troublemakers. But unfortunately, it's the liberals that have capitulated to them that's our biggest problem now. So I first encountered this in 2004 when I wrote an article about it. I'd actually written about it before, about people that had transitioned in the 1980s and had been rushed into it and felt failed and they regretted it. But that wasn't picked up because it was in a newspaper magazine and it hadn't got online. So the first piece I wrote that did get online was in The Guardian, in the days when The Guardian dared to actually publish anything contentious. And I was, from then on, a massive target, and they've never gone away. And I understand how the liberal capitulation has had much more of a chilling effect on the masses than have the individual trans maniacs, actually, because we're talking about some real, you know, seriously unwell people that go around issuing death threats for the slightest kind of misgendering or even less.
Yes. And they're the fringe, you know, they're the real minority. That most trans people don't get on this with this sort of thing at all.
I think that this madness, this extreme ideology, and the adoption of it by all of the organisations that you mentioned earlier, and then even at UN level, and governmental level, and the like, I think this is actually the biggest risk to trans people's rights, way more than feminists saying. We actually really should have our own prison wings, we should have our own hospital wards, and we should have our own domestic violence refuges and rape crisis centres.
I mean, I'm seeing evidence of that. I'm seeing evidence that real transphobia is actually on the rise as a result of this, because now people associate trans people with the extreme maniacs on Twitter who are sending death threats and rape threats and that kind of thing. And that's, so like you say, it's counterproductive.
Well, it is, but also, you know, a man, because it would be a man who kicks a trans person to death, sometimes because they just take offence at they might assume that they're gay. They just might go after anyone that to them is freakish, in the same way as lesbians are routinely targeted. Then I can't imagine that thug has read Radical Feminist Theory before going out and kicking a trans person to death. And I don't think they follow me on Twitter and think, do you know what? She's right. It is outrageous that we have to say chest feeding instead of breastfeeding. And yet we're blamed. So a few years ago, there was a really tragic incident. It must have been a good 10 years ago. A solicitor who I actually knew when he was presenting as male, who was a male to female transgender person, who then became Sonia from David and was standing on the underground platform at King's Cross with another trans person who was seriously mentally unwell. And that person threw Sonia under the train, and she died. And immediately the next day, and it was very upsetting because I had friends that actually had worked with Sonia when she was David. And I was actually blamed on Twitter for Sonia's death. Not just that the person who pushed Sonia under the train had read my tweets, because of course this was a trans woman that killed Sonia, but that I was on that platform and that I had pushed Sonia. Well,
physically and literally.
This tweet was quite quickly removed because I think they probably understood what libel law is.
Yeah.
So it's crazy.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but it does feed into a broader thing that is going on, is that people are blaming, in other words, an extreme trans activist would say, to even have the discussion, it is a form of violence in of itself, and that you are responsible for any violence that then takes place because you're feeding this kind of narrative. Yeah. And that's, again, I think that's just another tactic of characterising your position as the oppressive position.
Well, all of the violence.
I think that's what it is.
And all of the violence that we've seen in this war, and it's not two opposite sides of the same coin. It is not six of one and half a dozen of the other. It is not, oh, well, there's nastiness on both sides. It is not. There are one or two people that would call themselves gender critical feminists that are just nasty transphobes. And I won't share a panel with them, and I won't have anything to do with them, and they're a tiny minority. But all of the violence, all of the threats, all of the death threats, all of the abuse, all of the causing someone to lose their job or their college place or their reputation has all come from the extreme trans activists. And I myself was threatened with violence a year and a bit ago outside Edinburgh University after I'd done a talk on male violence, and there was a huge picket because feminists were speaking. And this is the other thing, of course. It's a very effective way to shut us down speaking about child sexual abuse, prostitution, rape, domestic violence and homicide. Because all they have to say is, well, they're transphobes, we can't have them on the campus. And more often than not, we'll be deplatformed.
Do you think it's as calculating as that? Or do you think it's more just a case that they have their principles and they see you as a threat? I mean, they claim that they see you as a threat to their existence. That's the language they use. Do you think that is a sincerely held belief?
It's an interesting question, actually, because I think it's both. So if you hate feminists because we raise the uncomfortable issues of male perpetrators, of men who commit rape instead of just women as victims, if we talk about men who kill women and men who put women in refuges as opposed to the nice cuddly victims, and if we point at men as the traffickers, the pimps, the sex buyers, the abusers, that we really do need to do something about. And if we are persuasive in our arguments, because of course we have every single bit of evidence about how prevalent male violence is towards women, and it's uncontestable, then people start to get very uncomfortable. And of course the misogynists hate this. They used to just be straightforward men's rights activists. And they used to say, women do it too. Look at Rosemary West. Look at Myra Hindley. Women also beat men up in the home. In fact, it's worse for men than it is for women. Women take our children away for no good reason. And now, of course, they don't need to do that because they just say that we're evil, toxic, transphobic, bigots. So it's not that they think, that woman's coming on the campus to talk about rape and how to stop it. It's, we can stop them. We don't want them to speak. We don't like these bitches. So let's just not have them because they're old style second wave feminists, or as one of the trans activists or one of the allies referred on Twitter to the brilliant Suzanne Moore today, just a hag. We're just hags. So I don't think it's conscious. It's not a conspiracy. It's a very handy way for these men to shut the bitch up and still be seen on the side of the righteous or the right side of history.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. So you're really talking about an effective alliance between the kind of old men's rights activists and the liberals who capitulate with that view.
Completely.
And that's a complete storm because that gives a kind of credibility to that kind of misogyny.
It is. And I'm 58. I was there through the Section 28 horror where schools were told, teachers were told that they weren't allowed to present to students anything about same-sex relationships or identity that was positive. In other words, it was anything but negative. And I'd grown up in the 1970s in the northeast of England on a working-class council estate, and it was really hard coming out as a lesbian in my teens. It was very, very hard. And I'm not alone in that experience. By the time we got to 1988, when Thatcher had put through what was known as Section 28, I was by then 26. I'd been an activist for a long time. I've been a lesbian for even longer. And I had a big community of support around me. And we protested Section 28. And the lesbians were the most creative about this. We abseiled the House of Lords. Some lesbians chained themselves to Sue Lawley's seat when she was presenting the news live on BBC. There were some brilliant actions. Gay men, less so. They were a little bit, give us our rights, please. We can't help being gay.
Well, they're not as tough.
No, tolerate. You know what we're like, big butch lesbians against all the Nancy boys. So, you know, we were very well aware of what was at stake for kids growing up in class and going through the same bullying that we had endured as, you know, older lesbians and gay people. But what happens now with the liberals is they're told by these lefty men that the quest for trans rights today is exactly the same as what we went through with Section 28 and lesbian and gay rights. And it isn't the same. It could not be more different.
So if someone were here right now who was making that point, what would you say to them to explain that difference, that distinction? How would you do that?
I would say that when we were fighting for lesbian and gay liberation, we were demanding an end to discrimination. We were demanding equality under the law, and that the law protect us from losing our jobs, losing our children, which lesbians did all the time, losing our housing, and being beaten up in the street. Really straightforward. And we were fighting against the kind of legislation that led two terrible things happening to us that didn't protect kids from being bullied and becoming homeless because they were thrown out of their home. What the extreme trans activists are demanding is a total capitulation to a fantasy, to surgical and hormonal treatment on the NHS that would then allow them to legally live a lie and have a different sex on their birth certificate and say to all intents and purposes they had been born female or male, if they, in fact, their birth sex was the opposite, that they have to be allowed to, such as the case of Freddie McConnell, who went to court to demand that he be registered as his child's father that he'd given birth to, that women who have fought for our own changing rooms, our own sports facilities, our own prison facilities and refuges, admit male-bodied trans women who are sex offenders and not say boo to a goose. Lesbians and gay men were not demanding any such thing, any such fantasy to be capitulated to, nor were we asking for medical treatment to allow us to live a lie. We just said we are how we are, who we are, however we got here, and we demand the right to live as equal citizens. Now, trans people, this is what the kind of old guard trans rights activists have always said, those that say, look, why should we lose our jobs because we wish to live as the opposite sex? Why should we be made homeless? Why should we be beaten up in the street? Well, who is going to argue against that unless you're a bigot?
Yeah.
And they're the kind of equivalent rights that we were demanding. This is completely different. And also, the misogyny of the extreme trans activists and the demand that women capitulate to all of their demands and shut up about our biology and our experiences of fear of seeing an erect penis in a changing room when we've been raped the year before, for example, is not about rights. It's about bullying and domination.
Also, I think with the gay rights movement, there was more of a willingness to discuss the point, to persuade people. I don't recall people calling for people's arrest if they were using the wrong terms about gay people and that kind of thing. And that seems to be something that's happening now with the trans issue.
Well, it is. And as women, as feminists, when we are not protected under hate crime legislation. And actually, nor do I want an extension of hate crime legislation. I don't want hate crime legislation. I want crimes to be detected and treated with the severity that they should be. But we as women have been told time and time again that there's nothing that we can do legislatively or to change the cultural view when we are treated in the most appalling way. And that just has never been made available to us. And when we demand that the most sexist depictions of us are corrected or removed, we're told, what on earth are you talking about? And yet, as soon as a demand is made by these trans Taliban, then, you know, this seems to result in an immediate shift.
Well, they're scary. I mean, all the extreme elements are scary. I mean, you mentioned the incident in Edinburgh University. I also saw a video of you that went viral, I think it was in Bristol, was it 2 years ago, where you were trying to get into the building to give your talk and young people in masks had sort of lined the stairs. I mean, that's intimidating, isn't it? I mean, you didn't seem intimidated, to be honest, because they were all just young, posh kids, you know, but you didn't seem that way.
No, I was intimidated. I'm always intimidated when there's a baying mob screaming for my blood outside a venue that either I'm about to give a talk in or, as the Bristol scenario, report on it as a journalist, which is my job. And these little blue-fringed public school-educated idiots thinking that they had the moral as well as physical capability to disrupt this event and to stop it from going ahead. And the idea that people would listen to them is astounding to me.
Well, it was so entitled. I watched the video. It was so entitled. It was this demand of, you know, they kept saying, you're free to go. You know, almost like they're granting you permission of where you can and cannot go. It was really ugly, actually.
Vile.
I mean, you've experienced a lot of this, particularly with no platforming. And I did want to ask you about this because I did listen to the debate that you recently did for Intelligence Squared on cancel culture. And you were with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and you were talking, and on the other side was Kehinde Andrews and Billy Bragg. What I noticed about their position is they didn't seem to understand what was meant by cancel culture. What they thought that cancel culture was simply holding people to account, particularly the rich and famous, holding them to account for their views when they say something a quote unquote problematic. But as you pointed out in that debate, but I don't think it got through that actually cancel culture is this retributive policy of harassment where you target often people who aren't rich, who aren't famous, their employers, they lose their jobs, they lose their livelihood. That's what cancel culture means. I was actually quite frustrated listening to the debate because I didn't feel that they even understood what they were debating about, really.
Well, you know, they're blokes and, you know, both Andrews and Brad.
So they don't.
By blokes, what I mean is they're a particular sort of quite full of themselves, you know, men.
Mm.
Who just thought,
I would agree with that.
You know, we'll just knock these women down. Oh, God, you know, they must be really regressive and right wing. You know, we understand this is just about calling David Starkey or the Daily Mail to task when they're misogynistic, when they're homophobic and when they're racist. Bragg, of course, well, he's a grandstander, isn't he? I mean, he pretends to be this working class hero and, you know, the kind of, you know, fighting for the oppressed. And he's just a pain in the arse. I mean, neither of them were listening to us. They had their arguments well sorted out.
That's what I thought.
I mean, Andrews hadn't prepared. He clearly hadn't prepared. I mean, he really didn't come across as impressive at all. Bragg had read. He'd prepared his talk. You could see that he'd set up his room with his guitars and his backdrop to look all kind of like, you know, Billy Braggish, and he had his, I think he was wearing double denim, and he'd rehearsed.
Oh, well, I listened to it on Spotify, so I missed all that. I missed the pleasure.
Oh, it was great.
I just thought that, like you say, they had an idea about what you were going to say, and therefore they didn't really listen to what you actually said. I mean, the straw man that kept getting repeated was this thing about, well, no one's entitled to a platform. I don't believe you ever said that. I don't believe, in fact, anyone has ever said that.
Look, you know, this isn't about no platforming. It's about deplatforming. As if I sit at home thinking, bloody hell, why isn't the Cambridge Debating Society inviting me to go and talk to them this year? I'm so offended. What I really want to do is get on a cold train, go there, speak with a load of, you know, boring up themselves students, have to sit through a dinner, do a debate, and then not get paid, and then go on another cold train home. That's not what happens. I go and speak to students all the time as an activist. About a third to a half of all of my work is unpaid. I'm lucky I've got a good, you know, which, you know, will very much upset the trans Taliban. I get lots of work. Thank you very much to them for really raising my profile. And, you know, I can afford to go and give back what I wish I'd had when I was growing up and didn't meet any feminists or anyone that would, you know, give me the benefit of the doubt. And so I go to many events and speak to students that are often in disagreement with me about issues to do with male violence and abuse, often about contentious issues such as surrogacy or the sex trade, you know, debatable issues. And we have a great time. And it's always really, really useful for me, and I hope useful for many of them. These are the events that I get deplatformed from. It's not that I expect...
As in you've been invited and then uninvited,
so I've been invited. They've put the publicity out. They've advertised it. They've got loads of students signed up. And then they publicly disinvite me. And the humiliation and actual damage to my reputation when that happens is awful.
But the mischaracterization of that is that people will say, oh, you're just... You know, you're complaining about having your free speech stifled, but here you are writing for a major newspaper. Mm. You're always on TV and things like that. So that's the mischaracterization. Mm. You're not saying that. Mm. You're saying this is about being disinvited from something.
It's about my unpaid work. I mean, the thing is, the reason why I'm on TV and the reason why I write in newspapers is because that's my job. I'm a journalist.
Right.
So what happens when I get disinvited is that it feels terrible. It feels completely humiliating. It's very, very upsetting. I have a thin skin. And it actually gets thinner with year after year of abuse that I don't think that I deserve. And it's really horrible for the students who then try to argue that I should be allowed to speak, that they were coming along to listen to me, whether they agree with me or not, to be told that they are transphobes and that they're, if they say one more word in support of me, they'll be kicked out of the debating society or the feminist society or whatever.
I think that's what's so, one of the really awful things about it is it's a minority of people making a decision of what someone else can or cannot participate in or listen to. So it's, it has that authoritarian quality to it in that sense.
It's horrible. I mean, a few years ago, I decided to agree to a debate at Manchester University with Milo Yiannopoulos. Now, the man's horrible. He's unpleasant. His views are repellent, made all the more repellent in my view by the fact that I think he probably doesn't believe half of it, but is perfectly willing to offend and distress people just for his own sake.
Well, he was a self-confessed provocateur.
Yeah, I mean, he's a deeply unpleasant person who I certainly didn't want to spend any time with. But just out of sheer spite to the students that had disinvited me from a talk at the Manchester University about male violence. Remember, it's never about the trans issue.
Yeah.
The Free Speech Society then stepped in, rightly so, on a matter of principle. And I'm not a blanket free speech supporter particularly, but they said, look, we'll give you a platform and we'll invite Milo and come and debate whether there's such a thing as, you know, feminism being silenced, whatever. Mm-hmm. And immediately that the women's officer at the university found out I was going, she deplatformed me, sent out a statement about how I was whorephobic, transphobic, biphobic, Islamophobic, polyphobic, the lot, right?
The lot, yeah.
And didn't disinvite Milo. Now, from where I'm sitting, I'm a lifelong human rights campaigner, and whether you agree with me or not, I've done a lot of work to support women who've been abused and to change the law to hopefully make things better for women who've been raped and prostituted and trafficked and the like. Milo, you could argue that he is a damn sight more offensive than me in his views on trans people, for example, just to take that one issue, and on women, he has said the most vile things about women and abortion and the like. But I was still willing to debate him. And there, a bit of a storm kicked up because even people that didn't like me were asking why Milo hadn't been deplatformed.
Yeah, the double standard, in other words.
And it was obvious why not. This is personal against lesbian feminists like me. It's just misogyny. They were happy for Milo to speak and to have that speaker's profile at the university, but not me.
Yeah. I mean, you had the same with Linda Bellos at Cambridge, and you think, she should surely be a natural ally. The originator of Black History Month, the sort of black lesbian, you know, someone who's actually, like you say, has done stuff, has actually, whose intentions are obviously good. And yet somehow she gets caught up in all this. I do find it astonishing.
It's against women. Women are targeted. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's been such a, you know, resistance to it. And then the idea that you have outlets like The Guardian or the BBC, for example, last week on Woman's Hour, where groups of socialist women, decent political socialist women who are fighting to maintain sex-based rights, are referred to as transphobic hate groups. Mm-hmm. It's completely outrageous. Or the likes of J.K. Rowling, who just because she's wealthy and powerful is somehow game for the worst kind of slurs and libel and defamation and this idea that you can say anything you like about her because she's wealthy. We don't have that standard about men.
Yeah.
People run around defending Polanski and Woody Allen and men who have, you know, are banged to rights for committing heinous crimes, and the lovies and the glitterati defend and support them, whether you agree or not that they should be defended or supported. This is not an even playing field.
I think irrespective of your opinion on those people, the double standard is self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. I've never seen anyone more mischaracterized than J.K. Mm-hmm. Rowling. I read her whole statement, and it's not this hate-filled, bile-fueled tirade, which is the way it has even been characterized in the mainstream press, which has absolutely astonished me.
Well, in the mainstream press, for example, Alison Flood, the books editor at The Guardian, has written a couple of pieces now where she has boldly stated that, you know, obviously death and rape threats are unacceptable, but Rowling has hurt a lot of trans people with her transphobic statements. Well, what? I'm sorry, but what? You can't say that about people. She isn't transphobic.
That's it. She just isn't. There's nothing transphobic in that statement or anything she's said. And whenever I've been in arguments on Twitter about this, it's always Twitter, obviously. And I say to people, can you just quote the transphobic thing that J.K. Rowling has said? You get this awful obfuscating, oh, well, you know, she sort of said this. That, and they can never do it.
No.
Because it's not there.
No.
You know.
No, I mean, I've come across groups of students picketing outside events that I've been at. Sometimes they get the right day, the right venue, the right time, you know. And then, of course, it's always a pleasure to see them with their placards if they're protesting my views on prostitution. Placards such as, you know, blowjobs are real jobs. There was one even when I launched my book on prostitution 3 years ago. One set of blue fringes that turned up outside the venue with the slogan, "Bindle isn't peer reviewed," on a placard. Standing next to the one saying, "Blowjobs are real jobs, shut the bigot up." And I thought to myself, Julie Bindle isn't peer reviewed. Oh God, I hope my mum never sees that. It would kill her.
They're not the smartest, this lot.
This lot, they often, and I always ask them, I say, where's the transphobia? Where's the whorephobia? Can you believe that's a word?
Oh, whorephobia is one of the new ones. There's a phobia for everything now. There's vegophobia as well, if you're scared of vegans.
Yeah, but they've never read my stuff. This is the point I make. They've never read because it would trigger them.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
Actually, I think we should talk a bit about that because, I mean, obviously you wrote a book on prostitution a few years ago. And of course, The Pimping of Prostitution, it's called. And The Pimping of Prostitution, Abolishing the Sex Work Myth. And I think a lot of people don't really think about prostitution very often. I think it's a kind of issue that, you know, because most people don't buy sex, most people are not part of that industry, it doesn't really cross their minds, and it is incredibly complex. But of course, you travelled around the world for this book, didn't you? You've spoken to pimps, to johns, to women who work in the sex trade. You've conducted all these interviews. It's a very comprehensive piece of work. And I think because so few people really think about these issues, it'd be really useful if you could you explain to us when you say that you want to abolish the sex work myth, what is that myth? And if you could maybe explain what the Nordic model is and why you support it, that would probably be helpful.
Well, the reason why I decided to write this book after campaigning for decades against male violence, which includes, in my view, prostitution, not just trafficking, the extreme end, but all forms of buying and selling women's bodies, is that everywhere I went, whether I was talking to liberals, to feminists, to people with no skin in the game, and I would say to them, what do you think should be done to solve the problems inherent to prostitution? Because we all know there are problems. And they would come back with one answer, which is legalize it. Make it safer for the girls. They would always say that. And so I started to ask why. Why did they think that legalization would make it safer? Now, bearing in mind, we've had legalization of brothels and tolerated street prostitution in Germany since the 1970s, in Holland since the year 2000, in Nevada forever, and Switzerland for decades. So we have had the experiment well tried and tested. Mm-hmm. And they would come back with myths. They wouldn't know anything about it because, as you've pointed out, most people don't know much about it at all.
No.
And they would say, well, it means they can get health checks. And I would say, well, are women not allowed to get health checks if they're not working in a legal brothel? Oh, well, it just makes it safer for people. Well, why does it make it safer? Well, because, of course, everything's above board and it's much safer than being underground. And I would say, well, in countries such as Germany and those states in Australia that have legalization, More trafficked women are found in legal brothels than are in illegal ones. The legal sex trade just provides a smokescreen for the illegal pimps. Most pimps don't want to pay tax. There are more murders of women under the legal regime in Germany, in the Netherlands and elsewhere than there are even in countries with a kind of mishmash of an approach, such as the one we have. And then, of course, they would move on to the Johns. They would say the punters, as we refer to them here. They'd say, yes, but isn't it being scared of being tracked down by the police that makes the punters nervous and they're more likely to carry out violence against the women? Well, no, because the punters are never arrested. Even if you actually have horrific situations, such as in the United States, the law where women are arrested out of brothels, which is terrible. I mean, no prostituted person should ever be criminalized, ever. But even there, where both effectively the Johns are arrested and the women in prostitution are arrested, you still have high rates of murder. So the only model where we've seen the murder rate drop, where we've seen women safely exit the sex trade, because the vast majority want to get out, they don't want to be doing this. The only model is where you deter the Johns, you deter the demand, and you decriminalize the person selling sex, and you provide every single thing that she or he might need to safely exit and to reintegrate into society. But you, the criminal law, and I don't mean harshly, I don't mean prison, I don't mean put them in the stocks, but I mean some kind of legal deterrent should be focused on the demand, because without the demand, we would have no prostitution.
So what do you say then to, I presume the main counter argument you get from even people on your side on most other debates is presumably that if a woman chooses to do this and is not coerced in any way, but wants to do and claims it is empowering, is that not a question of liberty, personal liberty?
Of course it is. Let her get on with it. Let her buy her second house in the Cotswolds. Let her fund her children's private school. Let her do whatever she wishes. Nobody is focusing on her right to choose. We're looking at whether men have a choice to commit an act that the vast majority of those in prostitution consider to be abusive, unwanted, coerced. And of course there are those exceptions. Of course there are those women that would say, well, I've never been raped. I don't have a substance abuse problem. I enjoy my work. Yeah, she exists. Of course she does. In the same way as the Black British man in his 40s, living in London, who says, I've never experienced racism. Why the hell do we need to have any laws pertaining to racial hatred? Well, he may well exist. That might well be his experience, but we don't legislate for the minority. We do not.
So it's a question of proportion. It's about the numbers.
It's
really
more than that, because actually the women often that are put forward in the media as those that enjoy their work, are choosing it, want bodily autonomy. How dare these bloody feminists tell me what to do? Well, we don't. We just say men should be called to task for paying for sex because it's not necessary. Their penises won't drop off. It's not something they need. It's not a human right like water and food and shelter. But it's the women often that are put in front of the camera to talk about how much they love their work. Or in fact, the men, because increasing numbers of gay men are also speaking out as happy hookers, sex workers. Mm-hmm. They are the ones often who are pimping, often who are actually now in the profit business and who are doing the type of prostitution that is less immediately harmful than the women who are being penetrated by 10 unwanted penises a day. And this might sound militant and dramatic, but this is the reality for women in prostitution. We need to think about what the sex of prostitution is and not just see the veneer of it. So the ones that speak about the happy hooker experience, often they're running some BDSM dungeon and you know, they have sort of non-contact S&M play with, you know, some geezer that likes being whipped across his tuckers and kicked up the arse while he cleans the floor with a toothbrush and then leaves 250 quid on the sideboard when he leaves, you know. So that they're not represented.
It's a very specific image.
we could fund the women's movement on a brothel like this. Let's face it, you know,
yeah,
no
true.
Sex necessary. But this is not representative of the vast majority.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Why is that the type of person we hear so much? If that's, as you say, a very marginal experience, why is that the one we hear that a lot on TV? The what you call the happy hooker?
Because they tend to be tourists, as I call them, so transient. Mm-hmm. They might think it's a bit sexy to fund their PhD by sitting on the end of a phone sex line for 6 weeks and then say that they're an ex-sex worker. I've met them in Nevada. Right. At conferences, I've seen lots of these women from Nevada University, middle-class women, a bit messed up maybe just kind of think it's trendy, the anthropologist type, you know, get down with the sex workers. And they're doing their PhDs on some aspect of prostitution and they hang out in a Nevada brothel for a few weeks. And then they stand up and say at a conference, as a sex worker. Well, that's not representative of literally the vast majority of the millions of women who are prostituted across the world.
Yeah. I suppose there is a tricky moral question at the heart of it. And I'll try an analogy here, because I recently read Yasmin Alibi Brown's book on The Veil. And as she argues, that there is a kind of inherent misogynistic baggage to The Veil in terms of what it signifies, that a woman is the commodity of the husband, and that she is responsible for the lechery of men. And yet there are women, and you often see them on television, who will say, but I wear it as a form of empowerment for myself. But at the same time, we know that lots of women are forced, coerced, threatened to wear it. So what do we do in that situation? If we ban the veil, you see, then are we not encroaching on the liberty of women? It's a similar kind of thing.
There is a difference in that some women, and I think the veil is an abhorrence, and it is a symbol of our oppression, for sure. But I think for some women who wear the veil, they wish to be very visibly Muslim or visibly religious or visibly standing alongside her brothers who have been wrongly accused of terrorism, for example. So it's a fuck you to the West. And we can all understand that.
I can understand that. That makes more sense to me.
There's no cultural pride in prostitution. There is nothing in prostitution that is empowering for women. It is men renting an orifice for one-sided sexual pleasure with a woman he knows doesn't want to have sex with him. Otherwise, cash wouldn't be involved. And so there is no pride whatsoever. A whore is a whore, which is what the status of women in prostitution is. And this comes from men. This does not come from feminists, because many of my colleagues and friends who I work with on this issue and who helped me with my book and who I interviewed have left the sex trade, were abused in the sex trade, and said that when they were in prostitution, they would have stood up for their own right to be prostituted. They were the happy hooker. Right. You know, it was that kind of self-protective mechanism that many women being abused adopt. And I'm not talking about false consciousness here. I'm talking about something much more straightforward than that, which is that these women have to survive, and it's a life of hell. And nobody helps them get out, because we're too busy talking about sex workers and boyfriends instead of pimps, and laughing about the punters rather than looking at these men as people that really should know that it's wrong to have sex with a person who doesn't want to have sex with you. Under any other circumstances, we call it rape.
Does it get to you that you're often having to make this argument against people who are your allies?
No, I understand it. It's really, really hard, because we have been inundated with mythology about prostitution. We are surrounded by it. We have the likes of Brooke Magnanti, who writes books about it. And she's someone I would describe as a former tourist into the sex trade, who then becomes a character played by Billy Piper on ITV that then further indoctrinates people into the fun and games and naughtiness of the sex trade, as opposed to the reality. And on the other hand, we have the extreme version, which again isn't helpful, which is the trafficked Moldovan woman chained to the back of a transit van and then thrown into a brothel in London and kept tied to the bed whilst 50 men rape her a minute, or women on the street who are close to death from heroin abuse. These extremities are not useful for actually getting the message through to people, which is about the essence of prostitution. It's about men claiming the right to have sex with a woman who does not want to have sex with him, and that he has the right to do that because he wants her to do certain things in prostitution that he knows his wife and girlfriend doesn't want to do. And that there's a subgroup of women, often indigenous women, black women, poor women, women in the worst kind of situation, care leavers, women who've been trained into prostitution as children by being sexually abused. This is the common profile. This is the usual profile, I'm afraid, of women on street and off street. This isn't to say these women don't have agency. This isn't to say these women are robots and just rag dolls. Of course, these women are extremely strong and resourceful often, if they live, and do incredible things to actually escape their situation, despite the pimping and the violence that they live with. But the reality is that it's the middle ground that we need to look at. The brothel round the corner from me in Hornsey, where people have just ignored it for years, including the police and the local authority, where there are women in there from Albania and there's a Russian pimp. And then you go down the road the other way and there's a load of Thai women running a massage parlour, some of whom will have been trafficked, some of whom are here legally, but none of whom will want to be in there.
It just seems to me that a lot of the battles you fight must be exhausting, because more and more increasingly you're being seen as the more marginal. But like you say, your version of feminism is an authentic, would we describe it as second wave feminism?
Well, it is described as second wave, but I just think it's proper feminism. It's feminism that benefits women. And I take your point about the massive resistance to these ideas, whether it's about the kind of extreme trans ideology or prostitution or even male violence and the prevalence of that, and about women being oppressed as a class. That's all seen as what you would call second wave feminism, but it is actually just feminism for women and feminism that doesn't benefit men, but that would eventually, of course, benefit men, but that this isn't something that men will sign up to, because the way I think about it is, if men applaud the type of feminism you're involved in and they love it, there's something seriously wrong with your feminism, because this is a challenge to men.
So can a man be a feminist?
No, but there are men, many of whom I know, who are feminist allies and who are really on the ball about the way that patriarchy works and about how, you know, this is that women are oppressed as a class in the way that they might recognise that there is something inherent to black people's oppression in the United States, for example, or particular groups of people that live in the world right now. So no, men can't be feminists because they take it over, you see. They want to dominate and they want to rewrite it. And that's what the men are doing in feminist societies. And on Twitter, they're saying, shut up, bitch. We know feminism better than you. Feminism is intersectional, by which they mean you should include men. That's what intersectionality has come to be understood as.
Yes, and that's not what intersectionality meant originally when it was coined in the late 80s. I mean, but the pushback you'll get to that is that, in a sense, aren't you playing identity politics as well? Isn't feminism about ideas, and therefore can't anyone embrace those ideas?
Feminism is about ideas, but it's also about action and a call to liberation. So I wouldn't describe feminism as identity politics because it's 3.5 billion people. So it's half the planet. So it's not an identity, it's a reality. I don't identify as a woman. I have womanhood imposed upon me. I would much rather just be a person, an individual, just the same as you, without having to use any pronouns. Just be human beings. I know we'd have to change all the language and that would be a pain, so let's not bother. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't want to get to the end of my life and still have to say it's not safe to go into a changing room in Topshop with a bloke. Because I don't think that men are programmed to be abusive to women. I think they're just given permission.
So in this sense, this might explain this rift between, to give it a shorthand, the second wave feminist, liberation feminism, and intersectional feminism, what we might call third or fourth wave feminism. Is that because, of course, for an intersectional feminist, womanhood is all about identity. It's something that can just be lifted off the rack you know, maybe that's what it's about. Maybe there is that distinction.
Yeah, I don't know what it feels like to be a woman. I only know what it feels like in relation to living under patriarchy, living under some kind of fear or knowledge that male violence is endemic and it shapes girls' lives as they're growing up, whether they're in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, California, or the UK. That's not to say that this is an everyday experience for all women. Of course it isn't. But we're aware that if we get into a taxi and we've had a few drinks, we know that we're at risk. We're not only at risk of sexual assault, we're at risk of them being told it's our fault when we do report it, if we report it, which is highly unlikely. And there's a reason for that. It's because of patriarchy. The identity politics thing winds me up to the point of just fury. I don't have an identity as a woman. I want to get rid of that identity because I just want to be a human being. And I genuinely don't know what it feels like to be a woman. I know what it feels like to menstruate. I know what it feels like to have breasts. You know, there's all kinds of things. I know what it feels like. But there is nothing inherent about womanhood at all. So it's not an identity. And the fact that it can be just now designed to fit all, that men can pick this up as something that they fancy trying on, like a new dress, is outrageous. They don't take the oppression alongside it. They just take the bits that they want, the performance art, or in fact, the right to speak over us. That's what they're getting when they identify as women now. I mean, the extremists, not your regular trans person.
I mean, you're talking about emphasizing the material reality of what it is like to be a woman in society. And I mean, I have to say the identity politics thing, because I know we met actually on a panel about identity politics about 5 years ago, and it felt at that point that it was something that was going to, it was going to just die a death. But it's actually gone the other way. And it feels as though feminism in particular, now that, you know, you see all these people on social media saying that, you know, if your feminism isn't intersectional, it isn't feminism. You know, you hear that.
Yeah.
But how is it that, I mean, well, I don't know if you can answer this question, but how is it that feminism became so identity obsessed, I suppose?
Because it moved away from feminism for women and it became a feminism that benefited men. So it was all about individual choices rather than the material reality, just as you've said.
Right.
And the politics were removed completely. The politics were removed from feminism. It was all about, it was like a performance art.
Yeah.
And then women capitulating to men saying, well, men could be feminists too. And the next thing, they're keynote speakers at feminist conferences. And then, of course, you have to make concessions to them and say, well, of course, anyone can be a feminist because feminism's for everyone. Feminism is not for everyone. Feminism is for women. It's the only social justice movement, and I hate that term, but you know what I mean.
I do.
On the planet that centers women and girls. No other social justice movement. Black Lives Matter. You would have it from reading about the origins of Black Lives Matter, for example, that this is a female-centered movement. But again, it's dominated by male voices, as is the workers' movement, as is the disability rights movement. This is the only movement that's for us because we are pushed out of every single other movement. I mean, look at the labour movement right now. Look at the Labour Party right now. Women are being told that they are hate mongers, transphobic bigots, for saying that we have a right to women-only spaces. So feminism has to centre women, and it's not an identity, it's a reality.
I mean, now you have people with male anatomy being voted Woman of the Year. Ooh. You know, it's difficult. Is this what your new book is about, though? Because you've got this new book, Feminism for Women, it's called The Real Route to Liberation, which is out in February. And it's described as part manifesto, part a call to arms. Is this what you're trying to do? You're trying to bring feminism back on track to the realities of life?
Well, you know, I wish that I was so powerful that I could bring feminism back on track. But thankfully, there are thousands upon thousands of young women, some of whom I've interviewed, obviously not thousands. One can only do so much book research, as you know, Andrew. But women that I've interviewed in a number of countries around the world that are saying, enough of this bullshit, enough of this twisting of what intersectionality means. This has to stop. We are now going to actually stand together and say prostitution is abuse, trans women are not women, and the veil is not a liberating piece of clothing. This is what's really important, the fact that so many more women are moving towards these politics, not because they're dredging up second wave irrelevancies from the 1970s, which was pre-internet and almost prehistoric, which is what we're always accused of. Feminism is timeless. It's about liberating women from our oppression. And the tactics change and the tools change. And of course, men change, thank God, because we don't believe, we are so non-essentialist. We do not believe that boys are born bad and that girls are born victims or good. So the women's movement is galvanizing all over the world. And by which I mean proper feminism. And these kind of fun feminists, the faux feminists, the ones that pander to men and put men before themselves, hopefully they'll learn. But in the meantime, they're doing a lot of harm.
That sounds quite optimistic. Your perspective seems quite optimistic there, because I keep hearing people saying this is a generational thing. Mm. I mean, I've a friend who's a school teacher, and some of the girls were complaining about Germaine Greer, and she had to say to them, look, you don't know more about feminism than Germaine Greer does, you know, but there was this generational element to it. And it's people like you and Suzanne Moore, who you mentioned as well, that are bearing the brunt of it, I think, sometimes. Am I right in that?
You are right, but it's also an ideological battle, not just a generational one. And I do think that we need, as older feminists or more experienced feminists, we need to mentor and support young feminists, because without our support, they are going to be just completely destroyed by the bullies. It's hard. Feminism's hard anyway, because you're saying to men, we're criticizing you and we don't want your approval and we don't want sex with you sometimes. Even say that sometimes. That's why lesbians are particularly hated by this new woke crowd. But the young women need our support. And if we don't give them that support, they will fold under the pressure, because the level of misogyny and bullying towards women right now that dare to speak up for our rights is, it's hell.
How are you going to encourage the younger generation to embrace what you call proper feminism when you've got, like with The Guardian, what was it? There were more than 300 Guardian employees wrote a letter complaining about Suzanne Moore's article and saying that the fact that she had an opinion, a gender critical perspective, she was making their employment unsafe. That was the word they used, unsafe. That's the majority of The Guardian employees, isn't it?
Suzanne Moore and the feminist writers that have been pretty much pushed underground, which is a disgrace, are the best thing about The Guardian. There are some really hideous bullies working at that paper. Some of them are section editors. They dominate conference. They are utterly vile about women, many of them. And the culture is one of deep anti-feminism at best and sexism and misogyny at worst. And what they don't realise is that they are performing some kind of cultural appropriation themselves, because they're just capitulating to the US Guardian lot, who clearly are talking about real transphobia under Trump rather than feminist critical theory about extreme trans misogyny. And they don't seem to see the difference. They think that we're the same as the US. And of course, the US think that they just dominate everywhere anyway. But the problem is, I really hope Suzanne Moore gets 10 million brilliant job offers if she ever thinks about leaving that paper. Because she really is so brilliant and her treatment has been disgraceful, and any newspaper would be lucky to have her. But I think that The Guardian has fallen down a hole and I don't think it'll ever climb out, because women are leaving that paper in droves and women are stopping reading it. And that's a terrible shame. It's the paper that I actually cut my teeth on as a journalist. And Kath Viner gave me my first break in journalism. And it's really sad to see what's happened to it.
Her writing on this has been actually brilliant. And I think she's, you know, it's bad enough being called a transphobe when you're obviously not. Suzanne Moore is obviously not a transphobe. When she's been called a transphobe by her colleagues, I just don't know how you make sense of that.
Just imagine how she felt when that happened.
Yeah.
And imagine that they were able to do that and get away with it. Quite unbelievable.
Incredible. Well, thanks, Julie. We're out of time, but thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure.
Really appreciated talking to you.
You too.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Andrew.
You've been listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Julie Bindle. Thanks very much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, why not like and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes? And if you've got a mind to, why not go and check out some of my articles at www.spiked-online.com. I would also highly recommend that you pick up a copy of Julie Bindle's most recent book, The Pimping of Prostitution, Abolishing the Sex Work Myth. She really is a fantastic writer and expresses her ideas with such clarity and passion. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. See you next time.